Previously on Long Lost.
Do you think there was something special about your family that enabled it to carry on and keep looking?
Yeah, my mom and dad, strong in faith. Just the two of them staying together, because so many times people start blaming each other.
How did they see your family? Broken. We were missing parts. It also helped you to appreciate the family you had there. There isn't one of my brothers can say that my parents didn't do something extraordinary for him.
I'm Jack Elhai, and this is Long Lost, an investigative history series from Twin Cities PBS. I have sometimes habitually used the word unimaginable to describe bad happenings that, on more reflection, are really quite imaginable. A blizzard, a missed flight, the loss of a favorite possession, even a parent's or partner's death, all are imaginable. We can imagine them if we understand the cause. But the sudden and unexplained disappearance of three young children who once enlivened your family, most of us wouldn't know how to start imagining that. It's a kind of loss called ambiguous loss, a loss without knowing its cause and without resolution. Betty and Kenneth Klein went through that truly unimaginable experience. So did Gordon Klein, the older brother of the missing boys. Gordon has done his best to explain to us how this felt to him, but he's limited by faint memories. And Betty and Kenneth died some years ago now and can't describe their feelings. But others out there have gone through catastrophic, ambiguous loss, more than we'd ever suspect. And here in Minnesota, one woman in particular has been identified with that kind of loss. In attempting to understand what the Kleins went through, I thought we had to talk with her. She invited us to her home in St. Joseph, Minnesota, about 75 miles northwest of Minneapolis-St. Paul, a bit further along the same stretch of interstate highway that leads to Monticello, the longtime home of the Kleins. She and her husband, Jerry, with their family, have lived in that St. Joseph house since long before the catastrophic loss of their child that changed their lives. A sign at the entryway says, "Hope inspires people to seek joy." She offers us coffee, and we settle in the kitchen to talk.
Are the tapes rolling now?
Yeah.
It is.
Okay. Okay, he's ready.
Okay, great.
And right up, this is your coffee too, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, you're welcome.
Overlooking the table is a collection of framed mementos and photos from her lost son's short life. I'm nervous. Once again, this story has brought me face to face with someone whose loss I can't comprehend.
I'm Patty Wetterling, and Jacob was kidnapped on October 22, 1989, just a half a mile from our home. What was unique about it was a witnessed kidnapping, and that doesn't happen a lot. So we knew right away that somebody had taken him, which makes our case a little different than what they're going through. But the part that's the same is that it never goes away. You know, for 27 years, we searched for answers. Where is he? Who did this? What happened? And those are common factors. You know, where are they? Was somebody else involved? And just simply what happened? People can't just vanish. You know, there has to be some reconciliation. Your logical brain just tries over and over to figure it out. And I understand the longevity. We couldn't stop, because we needed to find Jacob. We didn't have any proof he wasn't alive, so I believed he could be out there. But also, there was a man out there who steals kids, and I felt like kind of like a social responsibility. If people had given up on Jacob, they still should be very concerned about whoever did this.
Like many Minnesotans, I remember when Jacob was abducted in 1989. Because his kidnapping had witnesses, we all knew a bad crime had been committed and something evil had happened. Back then, I had no children and was far from comprehending how the Wetterlings felt, but the news reports were chilling, and it all felt hopeless to me.
when he was taken, I've reviewed tapes at the beginning, and I was in shock. I know I was staring off into the distance, and Jerry was trying to ask for help. But our reality was about 50 people turned him in as a suspect because they didn't like the way he looked on TV. He didn't cry. He didn't, you know, wasn't sad enough or something. And so he finally just threw in the towel and said, they don't want to hear from me. They want to hear from you. And so it became just a burning inside. You have to do something. And then I just kept talking to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And they kept telling me, kids, come home. Don't give up. That and I had this visual. I was lying in bed one day and just pulled the covers over my head and said, I can't do this. It's too hard. It hurts too much. I can't do it. I'm never going to get out of this bed. And I had a visual image of Jacob curled up in a ball somewhere saying the same thing. I can't do this. They're never going to find me. It's too hard. And I began this dialogue and it was like, hold on, Jake. We will find you. But you have to stay strong. And at that point, it was a conscious decision to get out of bed. Up until that point, I everything inside of me just wanted to curl up in a ball and give up.
The investigation into Jacob's kidnapping was open for a very long time, but there must have been periods when, it seemed to you, not much was happening,
right.
Nothing new was coming in. So how do you maintain hope during a time like that? And is hope always helpful to maintain?
It was to me. What happened was initially with the investigation, they told us these crimes are typically sexually motivated. Person's probably done it before. Then you read homicide studies, you know, most children who are kidnapped and murdered are killed within the first 3 hours. And I had this glimpse because of the questioning, you know, they had to interview us and they were giving us information. And it the world was very dark. I couldn't live in that world. You know, who would do this to a child and what kind of horrific things were happening to him. And I couldn't live. It was killing me inside. And I chose to focus on like the National Center's work. And it's kind of like if you have a terrible illness and 98% of the people die within the first 6 months, and you want to be the 2%. And that was me. It's like some of these kids are alive and out there. I wanted Jacob so badly to be one who made it home. So that's where I put my energy. And it was probably one of self-survival. I saw that world of law enforcement and bad guys, and that was so far from my world, my reality, that I had to turn to hope. And that kept me alive for a lot of years, and it grew and expanded. I know she would understand that too, because then they had other children, right? Mm-hmm. And so you see a child, a baby that's born, and there's nothing more hopeful than that. You know, you hope for this world of possibilities for every child.
One of the reasons why I wrote the book and why we're working on this podcast is, you know, perhaps to flush out somebody who remembers something or
right.
has any kind of information at all, and to help the clients reach an end of
yes.
some kind, because they, you know, the police concluded at the time that a crime had not been committed.
Right.
And now it seems clear that one had been. And so what they want is a resolution.
Yes.
And if by some miracle we're able to help them arrive at a resolution, that some new information comes out, I've been wondering a lot, what will that do for them?
Yes.
And so you reached your resolution. You found out what happened to Jacob, finally, after a long time. What did that mean to you, to get that information and to learn?
Oof. It was devastating. It was devastating to hear, but I needed to know. I absolutely needed to know what happened. But when we found what happened, it was so stunningly, you know, we searched for almost 27 years and then our case was resolved in 8 days. 8. It was shocking. And we got to hear from the sheriff what the confession had said that he did and how Jacob had, you know, what he had lived through his last couple hours of his life. And it was horrible. It was horrible, and it's been a long process for me. And they may go through this somewhat, but it became my life work. So for 27 years, I was a searching parent, and now I'm not. So who are you? And what was that all about? You know what I mean? It had this sense of futility. I just spent so much of my life trying to do something. And yeah, other good things might have happened, but I didn't do what I set out to do. So I was personally devastated. Everybody else went back to work, but this was my work. So the journey has been difficult over the last 3 years to try and, now I'm a parent of a murdered child, which is totally different. Everybody views you differently. They talk to you differently. There's no hope in that. And I survived on hope. So that part has been really difficult for me, and I still needed answers. So there's some peace that comes with, Trevor said this right away, at least it was quick. You know, it was horrible what he had to go through, but the man told him to turn around and he shot him. It was like unbelievable. So I still have to deal with getting that scene out of my head sometimes. So that might happen to them, but at the same time, there is a calm. Nobody can hurt him anymore. You know what had the guy who took him is not hurting anybody else anymore. And you have a piece of you that has resolve and can reconcile with that. It might take some time. For me, it's taken a bunch of time, but I think our children are doing way better. And Jerry's got some peace. I'm working towards it. But it's not, you know, I think the worst thing is not knowing, and I'm not sure. It was pretty bad finding out too, you know.
Bad knowing.
Yeah, it changes everything. But I agree with you, you know, there's possibility of somebody knowing, or even, you know, if the guy who did it, he's probably not alive, he'd have to be really old. But they may have told somebody. So few people just keep these secrets. But it's time. I mean, the world needs to know, and they can have some peace too by sharing what they know or suspected. So I wish them those answers. I think the answers matter a lot.
You and Jerry must have put a lot of energy too into keeping your family together and home. As healthy as possible.
Yeah, at some point we were struggling. I think marriages can be hard on a good day. And this was not a happy time. It was incredibly stressful. And then the interviewing, you know, they'd interview him separately in one room and me in another. And then you come back and it's like, what am I supposed to share any of that? You know, what should I say or not say about what they asked? And I'd ask him a question. He'd say, who wants to know? I mean, it was really hard. Really, really hard. And at one point, the BCA agents came to our house and said, you need some help. We see you as struggling. Get some counseling. We want Jacob to have a home, a family to come home to. And so we did. And our other three kids were so devastated. We had to put a lot of energy into giving them back a world that they could function in. You can't live in fear. Trevor was with Jacob, so he had tremendous fear, and he never wanted to be alone. And we worked hard. It was not easy, and it's an ongoing, you know, effort, because it's like you have everything you own on this table, and then you throw it up in the air, and you have to rebuild it. And at that point, I made a really, it was like one of those lights things, and it's like I refused to let the man who took Jacob take anything else. You can't have my marriage. You can't have our other children. You can't have my belief in the world that Jacob knew. Mm-hmm. It's hard. We couldn't see him, but we could see his friends and we could see our other children, and we had to fight for that world. So the hope kind of expanded, mm-hmm, beyond just a simplistic which was, it was very real. I was always searching for Jacob. Everything I did was for that. And for other children, as I got beyond myself. At the beginning, you're very, very, very focused. But when I began to meet other families, I understood this was a bigger problem.
Like Patty and Jerry, who channeled their emotional turmoil into advocacy for missing and abducted children, began a foundation to administer those efforts, and even in Patty's case, launched a campaign to be elected to U.S. Congress, the Kleins focused on doing stuff. They found purpose in following up on every lead, plausible or crackpot, that came their way and could possibly bring the boys home.
I'm happy that the siblings are still fighting for those answers. That speaks highly of their family.
I think so, too. And they were raised, it seems, with a delicate balance maintained of mom and dad having a strong focus on finding the missing brothers, but also letting the other brothers know that they were still a family and getting the attention that they needed, but also observing things like birthdays and that kind of thing, so that the boys who were left knew who was part of their family and who wasn't there. If you could give advice to those siblings who are in the position of your children, you know, what would you say to them?
Well, I think the parents did a brilliant job in honoring the three that were missing and keeping that part of their family. Because there are I've met families where you can't talk about it. It's just don't ask, you know, never mention their names. And that's not fair to anyone. So in so doing, by keeping the three missing boys alive and honoring birthdays and stuff, it also adds value to each of them. You know, like you are incredibly special. You are unique and special. And the honesty is important. It was important to me. We never hid tears. We never hid, you know, fear. We talked about all of those things. And I think it's really, I'm happy that they're still remembering their brothers. And I think that that's a really big tribute to the parents.
A week or two earlier, I had had coffee with Pauline Boss, an emeritus professor of family social science at the University of Minnesota. She had coined the term ambiguous loss decades ago and had researched the Klein case. When I asked her what the Kleins were likely seeking after so many years of not knowing, she rejected the terms closure and resolution, saying healing was impossible. Instead, she suggested the term certainty. They probably most needed to know what happened to their boys. That would end the ambiguity of their family disaster.
If the Kleins never get an answer to their questions, what can the rest of us do for them?
You know what? This might sound surprising to people. One thing that happens when you have a missing child is nobody wants to say their name. You know, and it's like, just remember, it's like, I never forgot about Kenneth, David, and Danny. Having other people hearing that they carried them in their lives too, and that they remember, and that these people did exist, and they're a part of your life, and you still care. We can all still care. Neighbors who live there, you know, other kids their ages, you know, just let them know the impact that they had in their lives and the way that they learned to, you know, to care for their children or the things that they did differently because of. And I just think that we just all need to build a better, kinder world. We're all human and everybody's got a story. That's one thing I learned the most, is people would share their stories with me. And it's okay to share your story with the brothers who are still searching and say, you know, I can't imagine what you're going through, but I lost my brother to a drunk driver, or my brother was a classmate of your brother, and here's what happened. And just sharing the heart-to-heart humanity, I think the world needs a little bit more of that. And just showing that you still care, you still remember.
It's interesting. What do you think is behind that reluctance to say the name? Because I have felt that myself when I was researching the book and talking with the brothers about mm-hmm. the brothers who disappeared, that, I don't know, it was hard for me to say their names to them. I right. could say it easily to other
people. It made them real.
People. Yeah.
And I think that people don't want to hurt you, and they don't know if it'll help or hurt, and so they just avoid it. That's another thing. Our resource center has a support system for families. And so as we become aware of them, we can, you know, if they want to connect with somebody, we can be that bridge. This isn't a really old case, but there are others. And the National Center, actually, I'm wondering if they may have names of other families that are really old cases. And I know some have been solved after even longer than this because of technology. And or because of one little thing that somehow fit that final puzzle piece that made a picture.
Anything else that we haven't talked about that you want to add?
Well, the only other thing is you had asked Jacob's legacy, and I you probably see it's all over our houses, the 11 stuff. It was a sweet story. One of my friends at the National Center has a son who played soccer. And Jacob was wearing his number 11 soccer jersey when he was taken. And so her son wanted to put 11 on his soccer jersey for a tournament and called for permission. And we said, that was sweet. That's no problem. But our office thought, you know, we should have it mean something. So they kind of took the 11 of the things that we just used to describe Jacob. And I can't even recite them by myself because I get emotional in it. Mm-hmm. But I have them. I can hand them to you in a card. But be fair, be kind, be understanding, be a good friend, be, you know, good sport. The second to the last one, be gentle with others. I was at a school and these kids had made posters all over the school of these 11. And in the back of the gym was this be gentle with others on blue paper, but it was kind of sloppy looking. And I walked up and got close to it. They made be gentle with others out of Band-Aids. It was just, kids get it. And so often we know what we're fighting against, you know, hunger and poverty and all that. But what are we fighting for? And to me, that is what I would like Jacob's legacy to be, is it's fighting for that world that he knew. And it is a world that kids deserve, where they don't have to live in fear. And they can grow up believing in their dreams and going after them. And that's the legacy that I want. So yeah, I'll give you a little card with the 11 on. I had some man sent me a whole box of cards that just had Jacob's 11, and I kept writing my email and stuff on the back. So I finally called him and said, could you just print? So he just keeps sending me boxes whenever I need more cards. He's just sweet. People are amazing. They're amazing. They do things that you don't even think of, and it's sweet. There's more good people in the world than bad. And that's why I'm hopeful that somebody somewhere will help these people.
Yeah, me too. Well, thanks so much for this,
You're
Patty.
Welcome.
I brought this copy of the book
oh,
for you.
Oh, good. Thank
Jerry.
You.
Can I leave
yeah,
it here?
Please. Yes.
Patty handed me one of the printed cards listing the 11 good qualities Jacob displayed to the world. I wondered, what would be the legacy of Kenneth Jr., David, and Danny Klein? They were so young when they vanished, and so few people are still alive who can list off their good qualities. What we do know about them is that they were brothers, comrades, sons, who inspired intense loyalty and love in their circle. Their uncle, Jim Daniels, still misses their open, friendly faces 68 years later. Their parents searched for them to their dying day. Their older brother, Gordon, felt shaken to his core by their loss. What about the rest of us who didn't even know them? What path do the boys point us toward? I think they point toward the pursuit of certainty. For us beyond their circle, that's their legacy. Clearly, that's what has motivated Wright County deputies Jessica Miller and Lance Sauls. We must try to learn what happened to them, no matter how weak the chance now of finding out.
on the next episode of Long Lost.
Going back to the basement, if someone were to get a look at it and get in there, what would be your ideal scenario of what happens?
Working cold case, it's like a business, and this might sound cruel, and I'm gonna be just, I don't think you're gonna get a task force, but what you can do is try to make it alive. You gotta bring life back in this thing, because it's gone. Time shouldn't mean that we don't care.
Never forget they're human beings. Never forget this is not a story, this is not just an investigation, but it's somebody's loved one who's not come home.
Long Lost is the production of Twin Cities PBS, written by Jack L. High and produced by Katie O'Rourke. Original music by Robert L. High. Audio engineering by Terry Gray. Additional sound by Eric Poggle, Joe Demko, and Johnny Hagen. Managing Director Brendan Heenahan. Executive Producer Daniel Pierce Bergen. Production Manager Ted Hink and Production Coordinator Ann Guttridge. Special thanks to the Minnesota Historical Society and KSTP Archives and the University of Minnesota Press, publisher of Jack L. High's new book about the Klein case, The Lost Brothers. Funding for this podcast was made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and Friends of Minnesota Experience. You can reach us at longlost@tpt.org and visit us at tptoriginals.org/longlost to learn more about the case.